Samira, if I may ask you about the effect of kind of this retreat from democracy. Lot of, if you look at, for example, Kenya's a history with quote unquote democratization, lots of it was underwritten by support from the West. You know, from the US, the embassies are where people would run to when government tried to clobber you up and stuff. They provided resources for activists, NGOs organizing to confront it. What happens when they are no longer, or they have more pressing problems at home? Does that mean that we would then either have more space to do our own thing, or would we see a more effective clampdown by governments?
I think Somalia is a very good example. And the last 4 years of the Trump administration and exactly the effect it had on Somali leadership. I think the most leverage the international community had on Somalia was based on the US and the UK to a large extent, mostly the US. And to see them go through the process that they went through and the lack of interest in really democratization, a singular focus on just security matters, I think affected Somalia and is really part of the reason we are where we are today, that you have an electoral process that should have ended in February that's still ongoing. So I really think it's going to be positive for countries like ourselves, who the intentions might not initially have been good, have been genuine with the leadership. If the intentions are good, I think a hands-off approach might work, where the local actors are forced to come around the table and come up with systems that are not externally imposed. So in Somalia, for instance, it's either have elections or we cut off support, and the international community did cut off financial support, the money that we were getting directly to the central bank, but the IMF just bailed out the current government. But that's the kind of thing that happens. I don't know if that helps have a better electoral process or makes it worse. So I think it's indicative of the future that we will be left to our own devices. Lack of interest in the Horn, in especially Somalia, and the counterterrorism effort. And so I think it's up to Somalis to really chart out, the democracy that it wants, the form of government that it really needs.
Right. But if you look at what Biden has been saying about sort of revamping the US role in elections, and I know many people will push back and say perhaps you should start by fixing the US system. But still, there are resources that can come for efforts or for whether it's civil society actors, etc., to push this. You don't see that as something that we would
No.
lose if they don't
In
engage?
the context of Somalia, in the context of of places like Kenya, that might help. But in the context of Somalia, you really have a very short period to influence Somali leadership, and you have little leverage. And so I don't think we are priority number 1, 2, 10 for the Biden administration right now. So and
Although, I
that's
mean,
a paradise. I think that's paradise for the Somali politicians, so they can do what they need to do while the attention is not on them. And so, no,
right.
I don't think whatever the international community has to offer that will work. And that ended in Somalia when the SRSG was removed. So ever since then, we have weaned off that dependency, and there's really not much change to the impact. There's not much change to the lives of Somali people when you look at it, when you look at it that way.
Justin, do you think more people in the region are looking towards places like China and saying, well, that's a system that delivers progress, doesn't have too many issues with elections, they don't have to do it. Look at Rwanda, you can have people who win with 99% of the vote, but they have clean streets, you know, they seem to be doing well. So do you think many guys are looking at that and saying, well, let's go slowly on this democracy thing?
Yep, well, it would be surprising if people weren't looking at those things, particularly since both the Chinese government and the Rwandan government are quite pleased with their achievements in this area and quite like people to look at them. So, yeah, of course, people are looking at that. As always, you have to remember those are very specific societies, the product of very specific historical trajectories. So,
Right.
that, things that work so, in one place.
Yeah, I mean, assuming that there is some sort of ideological competition, if you will, sort of harkening back to the days of the Cold War and stuff, that we have a renewed one where there's a model that China presents, there's a model that the US presents. Do you think the region is leaning towards one or the other?
I would hesitate to say that at the moment, but yeah, there is clearly a sense, and I think it's a sense on both sides of that, that there are different models on offer here. And I think people in each of those countries would like to think that they're offering different models. How people in the region will react to that, I don't know. It'll be interesting to see over the coming months and years. But yeah, that is how it's very easy to present this in those terms.
Right.
If I can also add, okay. If I can also add on.
Yeah, go ahead, Rashid.
If I can, yes, before the thought disappears from my head, Isaias Afewerki is the guru of authoritarian learning. And in the last 4 years, I think he has been extremely busy inducting Farmajo as well as Abiy in the dark art of actually centralizing power, dismantling the federal state and locking up opposition and this growing climate of claustrophobia in the Horn actually stems from the triumph and the fact that the authoritarian school feels emboldened, not just by Afewerki, but also by China, a resurgent, powerful, assertive state, an America that is on the retreat, a West generally that is on the retreat. We are beginning to see, I think, the contours of this debate about whether Africa will take an authoritarian path to development or a democratic path to development. I think, sadly, the liberal democratic project is now tarnished, and old style Democrats like me and liberals are on the retreat. Back to you.
Right. There's a thing that I've been wondering about. There's a time, especially in the 90s, when Africa's problems were framed around leadership. And I think Francis speaks to this when he asks whether the problem or future of democracy is about transformative politics and leadership, and he cites Uganda. So it used to be, Rwanda rather, not Uganda. It used to be said that if only Africans had better leaders, that we would, whatever, get to Nirvana or be this nice Singaporean sort of place. And I think democracy presupposes the existence of better institutions as opposed to better, whatever, rulers. I don't know, Samira, what do you think? Do you think that the discussion is now changing? Are we hearkening back to saying, well, let's get just nice people who won't kill us and they will deliver economic progress?
I think it would be wrong to say that, you know, it's just you cannot just paint it with one brush. I think there's different views across the region, but there is that mentality, there is that sense that, you know, we have to get over and done with this process. But in places like Somalia, it's really, we are really at the beginning of this this entire game. So we are hopeful that it will bring change, it will be positive, we can fashion it to a way that works for Somalis. So we are at the beginning. Places like Kenya, you could say, I think they've learned that this is a system that can be, you know, manipulated in whatever way, and are willing to, you know, just go with the process. The public, you can tell, are quite, you know, fed up of the entire process. And sometimes there is a fear that the public could come in and change how things are done, to put it honestly. So I think you'll have to look at it from the different points of view. Places like Uganda, this should be the way to go for a long time. Places like Kenya, where I think at the edge where you might see, you know, a radical change from the public side. But for Somalia, I think it's good to go.
I'm sorry, I'm temporarily lost for words, Patrick. So I think we'll go on to the next question.
All righty. Rashid, you want to jump in on that? Or I can just move on?
Yes, I think there is one country that hasn't come up in our discussion. And I think for me, it is a very fascinating country. First of all, it has a very strong, I think, will to a democratic path. And this is Sudan. Has a very strong, a long history of actually struggle for democratic freedoms, for liberty, has a very well-organized civil society, have a strong labor union. And I think if there's one country, you know, in the Horn, which has the structures of actually a very strong liberal democracy, that has to be Sudan. Back to you.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, we followed lots of what happened in Sudan with the protests and the push to get rid of Omar Bashir and stuff. I mean, do you think that has been replaced by a more responsive government? It looks very much like a military style dictatorship that looks like what we have in Egypt.
I think the transition is definitely shaky. It is in problems. Also, the economic situation hasn't helped. Remember, the transitional government actually inherited a bankrupt state, and the economy hasn't improved. Sudan has done everything that they were asked but to do by the international community. The U.S. also lifted it from the designation of supporter of terrorism. But I think the economic dividends are only beginning to trickle in. And so it will take time for actually the country's economy to begin to grow. I think the economy is fundamental to Sudan, because if people don't see the economic benefits of actually democratization, then that creates disillusion. And this is why I think the international community has a vested interest in helping at least Sudan steer a democratic course, because we saw a threat actually last month when there was a coup attempt. And that coup was capitalized on massive popular discontent, especially in Eastern Sudan, about the prices of bread, the cost of living. And this, I think, is the dilemma, where you have a very good government, but also very fragile economic systems. And that, I think, disparity creates a big tension, which is exploited by, forces that want to return Sudan back to the dark days. Back to you.
I think we'll do a final round of just comments. I'd want to hear what you think is coming, what your predictions are for the future of liberal democracy, of the ideas that we have of one man, one vote, and what it represents, and whether you think Kenya will, or the region actually, will ever be a European style or American style a democracy, or might become like a Chinese sort of a dictatorship. Justin, do you want to go first?
Well, remember, there is no single European style. It certainly wouldn't be the same as the United States style. I don't think that we should ever view the history of the region in terms of a trajectory towards being something like what Europe or the US is now. I don't think that's kind of a very useful way of thinking about it. I do think that elections almost certainly have a considerable future in terms of the ways that people argue over what democracy is and how they should be governed. They will continue to play a part in those arguments. But those are not arguments that ever have a final point in any society. There's not a point where politics stops anywhere in the world. That doesn't happen. Even places that like to call themselves liberal democracies, actually, they're changing all the time. They've changed, they will keep changing. So too in this region. But I think elections will continue to play a significant part in the way that people argue about who should govern them and how they should be governed.
Right, thank you. And actually, that's a very good point about reminding me that these are not uniform places. It's all different wherever it happens. And I think the same can be said about the Horn. So maybe actually for Samira, do you think elections have a future in Somalia, have a rosy future, or will they continue to be as divisive and as problematic as they are now?
I think we just have this hurdle to go through the current electoral process. But as all the political elite have learned, there is value in, you know, strengthening the federal system and, you know, this electoral process. So I have a feeling that it will be positive going forward, depending on my rosy view that there will be a change of leadership in the next year. So I think it's going to be positive from my point of view.
Actually, Samira, before I think I can't let you go without actually asking about the Somali experience with regard to changes of power. I think it's the one Somaliland has been kind of the one place, I would say, where the regulars change, the changing of the guard, if you will, through an election has become almost institutionalized. You know, there's a vote, people leave. In Kenya, there's a vote, somebody's supposed to leave and becomes violence. So my question is, do you think that there is lessons that the rest of the region can learn by looking at Somaliland, by looking at Somalia itself, with regard to peaceful handovers of power after an election?
I don't know if there's a lesson really for the rest of the region, just because this is an intrinsically Somali culture and a Somali thing. So I don't know if it's something that can be replicated elsewhere. But this is the one time, just to be devil's advocate, that if your change of guard has gone so well, but a return of the same administration, we might not have the stability and security that we have seen in previous electoral cycles. So this might be one that that determines whether we stick to that principle if the current administration returns. But this mentality, this is a Somali mentality. Accept, they agree when they agree on a process that they feel, you know, they each had a balanced go at. They will let it go.
All right. Rashid, what do you think about the future of elections in Ethiopia and in the region?
I think I see three distinct trends. One, of course, is what I call elite compact democracy and democracy with quotes. This is Kenya and Somalia, where we have seen actually institutions that are supposed to manage and run elections become dysfunctional, largely because you have a very efficient system of elite compacting. So elections are either not run credibly or they fall apart, but that is okay because when it is crunch time and there is a crisis, the elites from the different political parties will come together and agree a compact, and then the country will return to some semblance of normality. So elite compact democracy is actually something which will be with Kenya for a long time. I don't think there's the elite in Kenya are heavily invested in accredible elections, largely because they have a very competent and efficient system of elite compact.
And does that mean also that Kenyan elections will always be violent?
But violence can be managed by elite compacts. You know, when Raila Odinga just came out and said, turned his forces back to Kibera, then everything stopped. No more riots. And, you know, so even the violence is managed by...
Yeah, but violence is part of this negotiation that elites
And the same similar pattern also is discernible in Somalia, where the electoral machinery and the electoral agency has completely broken down, and the electoral process is managed by five regional leaders and the prime minister. So that is an elite compact. Now, in Ethiopia, you have actually the structures and the rudiments of an institutional democracy, where you have a very competent and credible institution, agency, but then you are also beginning to see a more pluralistic system of actually politicking and campaigning, especially in rural Ethiopia. Now, the country that interests me most, and I think the country to watch, is Sudan. If Sudan succeeds, then I think we have probably the strongest candidate for a liberal democratic path in the coming years, largely because, as I said, you have a very strong iron will. You have the structures of organization, you have the culture of protest, the culture of not submitting to totalitarian governments, of rising up. All these, I think, put together makes Sudan a very interesting case. So you have these three paths to democracy. I don't know which one will eventually triumph.
Okay. All right. Thanks a lot for that. I'm afraid we've come to the end of our webinar. That time has just flown. So over to you, Pauline.
Thank you so much, Garth. Thank you to the panelists. And as Patrick has said, you can find the previous webinars on their website, on the Elephant, on HBF's site and our site as well. I still don't know if this webinar actually answered the question on whether elections in East Africa are a democratizing force or a violent flashpoint, but I think a lot of food for thought. And I think the key takeaway here is that I guess we cannot do without elections, and they'll still play a significant part on how people debate on how they're governed. So Asanteni sana, thank you for joining us today. I would like to say thank you very, very much to our partners, to Henrik Boll Foundation, who funded this series. I know this is the last one for this series, and I do hope we can pick up for the Kenya election that is coming up. I know that will be filled with hot debates, and so we're looking forward to that. To Patrick at the Elephant, thank you. This was a wonderful partnership, how you curated the series on your site, and expanded our audience base and enrich the partnership so much. Asanteni sana. To my team at RVI, to Fatima, who is behind the scenes, to Liz, to our communications team in London, thank you very much. I hope you have a good afternoon, a good evening, a good morning if you're in that part of the world. And till next time, Asanteni sana.